Good evening. David didn't tell the best bit of the story, which is I persuaded him to come onto my health authority because he used to talk from the heights of abstract policy. And I said to him, what a load of rubbish you talk about the health service. Come on to a proper health authority and we'll show you how it really works. Well, he was on my board for 4 years and at the end of it, he was still talking at this level. But we'd had fun during that time, which is also what I think is my abiding memory of John Selborne. I'm delighted to be here to talk during this tribute to him tonight. He was a gentle and persuasive colleague, but he played a major role in agriculture and the environment and in research in the UK. My first meeting with him was when I was chief executive of the RSPB, and I drove him to the station after the meeting, and we got into conversation about apples, and before I knew what was happening, he had demanded to be taken to my orchard and had actually identified all of my ancient apple trees and put little notes on each of them to make sure that I understood what species they were. So that was terrific. Very John. So if this is the sort of post-match analysis of COP26, it very definitely went to extra time. India and China scored in the penalty shootout when the otherwise excellent referee Alex Sharma temporarily lost control of the match. The small island states, alas, otherwise known for the purposes of this football analogy as Latvia, lost comprehensively. Though overall much seemed to be delivered. And I'm going to be slightly more optimistic than these two miserable souls in front of me and talk about some of the things that I think COP26 did deliver and then leave some messages for the government. The completion of the Paris rulebook is not exactly something that everybody talks about over breakfast, but that was an important deliverable, setting the framework of rules for carbon markets and hopefully encouraging people to be more ambitious about their enhanced nationally determined contributions since they know what the rules are. More countries than ever before were involved in the COP process and more have signed up to net zero, even India after a fashion. Coal was included in the Glasgow Climate Pact for the first time in a heavily diluted way, but at least it's a start. And we all know that 1.5 degrees can't be achieved while the world still burns coal. The side deals were probably more important than the main gig, with methane and halting deforestation as important parts of that. But they, of course, lack any of the formal monitoring and reporting mechanisms that the COP26 process applies. But there were sterling efforts behind the scenes, and that meant 133 countries did sign up to the deforestation deal. Now we here in the UK now need to show an example by not destroying or damaging our remaining fragments of important forests, our ancient woodland. There are still over 1,000 ancient woodland areas under threat in the UK. The joint issue of a statement by China and the US was an interesting development. I suppose it's the equivalent of the process in Parliament when the two chief whips confer behind the wool sack. We watch to see what these unusual as opposed to usual channels deliver. And there were some bits of process that I think are encouraging. Business for this COP didn't send the deputy postboy, but actually chairman and chief execs who were there in force. The commitment to come back next year with enhanced national contributions signals a ratcheting up process, which is welcome. And if we're back to football again, GFANZ, which is an acronym for the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero, has now doubled the assets globally under management for tackling the climate crisis. It's a small beginning, but it's a beginning. Of course, there were things that others have talked about that didn't come through. The $100 billion funding per annum funding commitment wasn't reached. The compensation for poorer countries and small island states for the impact of air pollution is still unresolved. And though nature-based solutions were talked about a lot, there were less mechanisms for their delivery and very little link up between COP15, the Biodiversity Convention, and COP26. Now, it is absolutely axiomatic that 1.5 degrees can't be delivered without restoring our biodiversity. And of course, adaptation did have some time in the sun. The budget was doubled, but that was doubling not very much at all. And though I welcome the agreement for a 2-year process for a global plan for adaptation, it's another 2 years, because the point has already been made that adaptation is going to be increasingly important, and not just in Bangladesh and the small island states and in the increasingly arid regions, but here with extreme weather events, with fires, droughts, floods, plagues of locusts, slaughtering of the firstborn. But the reality is, it's also going to be about immigration. The immigration pressure is going to increase as the populations of the world seek a living elsewhere when their territory becomes increasingly hostile due to climate change impacts. And we will feel that pressure growing, as we're already experiencing. So there were lots of agreements made at COP26, but will they be implemented? Who knows? So what next? Let me offer a plan for our government for the next 12 months. I'm not going to look ahead to 2050. I'm just going to be focused on the task in hand for our government. First of all, we are the president for the next year. This is a game of two halves, and we've got the second half still to come. Alex Sharma will need to re-energize the process, make sure the enhanced NDCs come forward, make sure that China and the US talking does have some impact, and try and knock India into shape. He needs to ensure processes for the implementation of the commitments that have been made, particularly the side deals. And he needs to make sure that we get over the line on the 100 billion annual funding, which may not be that huge amount of money, but it is a sign to the small island states and the emerging world that at least some action is being taken by those who caused the historic pollution. And of course, he needs to make sure that the promises of private sector funding are leveraged. Back in the UK, we need to lead by example. So I want to give the government an easy start with 6 examples that they could set. First of all, we need a zero carbon and biodiversity test for all policies right across the board. In my Select Committee on Science and Technology, which I'm a member of, we interviewed government departments about their plans for COP26. And I must admit, I fell apart at the seams when the evidence came in from the Education Department, where clearly they had no concept that education could play a role in climate change. It was unbelievable. So zero carbon and biodiversity tests for all policies. No more trade agreements without climate change parity being a precondition. If our farmers and our businesses are to meet climate change standards, we shouldn't be signing trade agreements with countries that don't. And that's bad for our companies, and it's bad for the planet. The third example the government can give is a strategic land use framework to make sure that we use that scarce resource of land most effectively for sequestration, for trees and peat to sequester carbon, especially with my hat as the Woodland Trust, the right tree in the right place and at a fast pace. But we also need a land use framework to make sure that we can deliver the transition to lower emissions, including methane, from food production, especially a reduction in meat and dairy and increases in plant-based food, as outlined in the National Food Strategy, while still retaining a vibrant and economically viable farming industry. My fourth example that the government could give is that we need not a scattergun of initiatives, but a properly sustained action plan with timescales and funding and transparent pathways that can be monitored for our highest carbon and greenhouse gas emitting areas, energy, building, transport, and agriculture. And the net zero strategy is not that. It's got holes all over it, as those of you who have read the recent report from the Aldersgate Group will know. And one simple little thing, for heaven's sake, Defra, and I shall use a technical term at this point, get the finger out. We and farmers have waited far too long for the environmental land management scheme to be born. One thing we do need to guard against, however, is that we don't let the government off the hook. They are putting too much faith in some key technologies, and particularly, in my view, in green hydrogen, which is some way away, but is worryingly crucial to many of the elements of the net zero strategy. Generally speaking, the government overfocuses on the white hot heat of technology, on hydrogen, on CCSU, and not enough on fiscal and taxation changes to reduce the price of climate-friendly technologies and increase the price of polluting goods and services, because we do need to foster and encourage substantial behaviour change that public and businesses need to make. My fifth example that the government should give is that all public procurement should adopt zero carbon targets. Public procurement is a huge lever to drive the development of climate-friendly goods and services. And it's not just in things that public authorities buy, but the whole market is conditioned by the size of that spending power. No government has really ever used that lever effectively, and the climate crisis says that we must. My sixth example is possibly the most important, because I don't think the Chancellor quite gets climate change. Most of the big changes we need to make in the UK need not just upfront funding, but more importantly, fiscal and taxation measures. We don't yet have a climate change commitment from the Treasury. Their analysis that accompanied the net zero strategy was all about other government departments and not about the Treasury's philosophy. Rishi Sunak needs to show that he has a more ambitious and thought through strategy beyond modest funding for the new technology development and implementation, like heat pumps and new nuclear and e-cars and whatever the latest announcement was this week. And he needs to set an example now in terms of stopping damaging subsidies by stopping the massive subsidy to Drax in inappropriate biomass extraction, which is adversely impacting on international biodiversity. But perhaps the most crucial thing for the future is twofold. One is ensuring that the system delivers a transition that is just. Now, this is not just an ethical point, both globally and nationally, but it's a practical point. In my view, there are already signs of individuals and farmers and business people getting into their heads that net zero measures all have an unacceptable upfront cost, which impacts most severely on business, on the poor, on whoever. And if that takes a hold, we will all fail. And secondly, we absolutely must keep faith with young people. We saw the power of young people to move mountains. They're going to inherit this mess. Their line in the sand that you saw on the slides. If we don't keep faith with that huge power of young voices, they will not forgive us, and we will not win through. Thank you.